You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Victoria Graham.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be in Germany as Merkel prepares to hold coalition talks with the Social Democrats.
Also, Adam Hug from the Foreign Policy Centre will join us in the studio to set the day's agenda. What do you have for us today, Adam?
We're talking about a couple of governments in crisis, with the US going into shutdown and Italy's government possibly soon to follow.
And we'll be in Ireland as the Dublin Theatre Festival marks the 60th anniversary of Waiting for Godot with a new production of Samuel Beckett's masterpiece.
Plus, we find out whether there's still space for the unloved and underused brand HTC with the company's Senior Vice President, Scott Croyle.
If a photo captures 1,000 words, what does a video capture? You know, it captures kind of an infinite amount, even just in a little 3-second clip.
All that, plus we'll get the latest from Jakarta, review the Brazilian newspapers, and we might just play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
First, though, let's catch up with the latest world news from Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The US federal government will start partially shutting down today after lawmakers failed to compromise on an emergency spending bill before a midnight deadline. The Senate rejected a budget bill passed by the Republican-led Congress by 54 votes to 46. The bill would have funded government provided President Obama's health care law, so-called Obamacare, was delayed for a year. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has blamed Republicans for the shutdown.
I'm reminded that President Washington, when he was leaving office, cautioned against political parties that were at war with their own government. And here we are tonight. But you do not use the threat of shutting down government to try to advance your policy agenda. That's just not the way it works. And that's what is called irresponsible. And that is why this is the Tea Party government shutdown.
It's not known how long the shutdown will last, and up to 1 million federal workers face being placed on unpaid leave. In a TV message, President Obama told US troops that they'll remain on normal duty status during the shutdown.
As president and as your commander-in-chief, I've worked to make sure you have the strategy, the resources, and the support you need to complete the missions our nation asks of you. And every time you've met your responsibilities and performed with extraordinary professionalism, skill, and courage. Unfortunately, Congress has not fulfilled its responsibility. It's failed to pass a budget, and as a result, much of our government must now shut down until Congress funds it again.
Venezuela has expelled 3 U.S. diplomats who it says were trying to sabotage the economy. The three have been given 48 hours to leave the country. President Nicolas Maduro says he has evidence they were involved in sabotaging the power grid last month and that they'd bribed Venezuelan companies to cut production. Announcing the expulsions, he said he'd had enough of abuse against the dignity of a peace-loving nation. The three include the chargé d'affaires, who is the most senior US diplomat in Caracas, as the two countries have not had embassies in each other's capital since 2010. Syria's foreign minister has claimed terrorists from more than 83 countries are killing Syrian soldiers and civilians. In a speech to the UN General Assembly, Walid Mualem compared this so-called invasion to the 9/11 attacks on New York. The UN has said the conflict in Syria is a threat to international stability. Countries neighbouring Syria say the massive influx of refugees is putting a huge strain on their resources. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has announced major political reforms which include new Kurdish rights. He's proposed lowering the 10% electoral threshold, which currently prevents Kurdish and other smaller parties from entering parliament. He says towns will be able to use their Kurdish rather than Turkish names. He also plans to end the ban on women public servants wearing headscarves. Turkey's been struggling to join the European Union for several decades, and academic Du Ercin believes these moves will help those ambitions. The US Senate Foreign Relations Committee has unanimously backed Caroline Kennedy, daughter of the late President John F. Kennedy, as President Obama's next US ambassador to Japan, paving the way for what should be an easy vote in the full Senate. The government shutdown means it's unclear when that vote might take place, but the lack of objections by the panel showed Kennedy's likely to be confirmed by a wide margin. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney Burnham. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Time now to set the day's news agenda. Excuse me. We're joined by Adam Hugg from the Foreign Policy Centre. Welcome back
Good
to the programme, Adam. Lovely to see you. What do you have for us today?
We're going to be talking about the situation in Washington where Democrats and Republicans are at loggerheads over trying to get a temporary budget bill passed. And also looking at Italy, where Berlusconi's up to his old tricks again.
Let's talk about the US shutdown first of all. Is this any great surprise that this happened?
No. I mean, to a certain extent, you've seen the trend within the Republican Party to sort of use every legislative and legal lever to try and chip away at Obamacare, given its sort of totemic position in the minds of conservative activists in particular. Obviously, we're going into a period now where so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was supposed to be rolling out.
It's supposed to start today.
Yeah, some starting today. Most things up and running by the start of 2014, with the exception of the employer mandate, which has been pushed back by a year due to various complexities. But basically, Republicans are now trying to use this short-term budget bill, the debt ceiling debate in later on this month, and the longer term financing package they got to pass to try and use to get chips out of this.
What many people find so confusing, and perhaps you could possibly shed a little light on this, is the way that the Republicans are so against the concept of Obamacare. The fact that they will politicise it to the degree where they will actually stop the Congress from passing a fundamental bill. The concept of universally accessible healthcare is not a new one, and many other governments across the world seem to be absolutely fine with it. What is it that is in a Republican psyche that stops them accepting the idea?
I think it's, I mean, obviously, as you say, as Europeans, it is somewhat difficult to understand the disagreements with the principles. However, the practicalities of delivering Obamacare in the incredibly complex American healthcare system is a very complex set of legislation and actions that interfere with the market in a way that Republicans find sort of fundamentally ideologically unacceptable. And obviously, there are significant short-term costs while setting this up. And it just basically undermines the traditional American healthcare model in such a way by forcing everyone to take on a certain degree of risk on behalf of those who are uninsured, which is obviously something that is fundamentally abhorrent to certain members of the Republican Party. And it becomes a situation where, in a run up to the midterms when people are going through reselection battles, in their local primaries, do you want to be the person who said okay and rolled over on Obamacare? So that they're being pushed to the right by their base. John Boehner, the Speaker, is in a very difficult position because obviously, because of redistricting back a couple of years ago, the Republicans are in a good strategic position in terms of the way in which their seats are laid out. But this could be the one thing that actually tips them over the edge in terms of, if they hold up the government for long enough, public support may be enough to push them out in next year's midterms.
And this affects so many people, 700,000 workers. The effects are going to be far more reaching than that. And also, will this have an effect on the markets as well, this shutdown?
Well, if it lasts for any significant length of time, I think it's about 0.16 or something a week if this is to continue. And obviously that can build up over time if no agreements reach. And, if we're potentially going through this a couple of times over the next couple of months, the long-term impact could be very damaging. But it also sends out a further signal on the back of previous issues around the debt ceiling and other sort of the fiscal cliff that we went over to a certain extent. And these debates that you keep seeing from the US, which obviously undermine confidence in their political system to actually deliver results that give stability for the markets is obviously going to be a significant challenge going forward. And it needs some longer term thinking about how they can get some stability into that. But there's no sign in the short term of that coming around.
No, indeed. We've been discussing this on Monocle 24, and the conclusion that many commentators have come to is that this really does show that the entire US administration cannot act in a bipartisan way. What do you think will be the long term soft power effects of the United States with this? When everybody will people actually lose confidence in the United States as a decisive nation?
Well, I think some of this happened. This happened in the mid '90s. The last time we had a full on government shutdown was between Clinton, in the Clinton era. And ultimately they were able to rebound from that. I think if you see the American economy surging ahead in the next couple of years, I think some of this will be forgotten. But it does sort of chip away at the overall credibility of the US's ability to get things done, and so it will have some long term soft power impact.
Should we move on to Italy?
Of course.
Where things are in a bit of meltdown there as well, aren't they, if I dare say it, because Berlusconi is trying to hold his party together. Do you think there's a likelihood of fresh elections on the cards? Because things are a bit of a nightmare. Can you give us some background to it?
Sure. Well, I mean, you've got a number of different things going on here. You've got the Letta government that's been sort of struggling to get past in the sort of coalition between him, the Democratic Party, and Berlusconi's People of Freedom Party. You've got Letta, who was not the initial candidate of the Democratic Party, acting as a sort of initially as a caretaker prime minister. You have Berlusconi in the process of reforging his old Forza Italia party and sort of potentially causing splits within there. You've seen noises from a number of Berlusconi's ministers in the current government sort of implying that they don't agree with their old leader's approach to this. I mean, ultimately, it's being triggered by a tax issue where they're trying to raise the sales tax to fund to keep the budget under the 3% limit set by the EU, and Berlusconi is using this as a tool to basically collapse the government. And certainly, three of those ministers have actually come out and said, one of them has said, I thoroughly understand his state of mind, but cannot justify or share the strategy. That's Berlusconi's health minister disagreeing with what's going on. So we could potentially, there are debates about whether Berlusconi can keep his party together and whether some of the more moderate groupings within that party will move away from Berlusconi's umbrella.
Who does Letta now look to for support to ensure that the government stays together? Because there's been a slightly impossible alliance of Berlusconi and Beppe Grillo from the Five Star Party. Beppe Grillo, I say, he'd never go into government with Berlusconi, yet finds himself strangely allied with Berlusconi in an anti-Letta position. But even if Letta does actually manage to keep the government together, who does he look to try and bolster support?
Well, with the current alliance of factions, it's basically how can you cobble together 19 votes in the Senate to keep his government going? And I think, to be honest, his most likely strategy in the short term is to see whether the more moderate faction on the centre right can be brought out of Berlusconi's umbrella. I mean, obviously, Letta himself is someone who's coming from a Christian Democrat background, who's probably best placed within the Democratic Party to lead those kind of conciliation discussions with the moderate centre-right, and Letta's been calling for the creation of a moderate centre-right party in Italy, which is obviously a bit cheeky given he's normally on the centre-left.
Thank you very much for coming in today, Adam. Really appreciate that. Adam Hug from the Foreign Policy Centre.
Coming up on Midori House, we're in Germany as Angela Merkel prepares to hold coalition talks. Stay with us.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said Brand Strategy Company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from. you get obsessed about the details. And if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
It's just coming up to 9:16 a.m. in Berlin, 8:16 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House. After the triumph of election night a little over a week ago, Angela Merkel and her CDU party now have to form a government. Although her party's victory was remarkable, returning the Chancellor to power for a third term, it fell just short of giving her an absolute majority.
So the horse trading now begins to form a coalition government. Many predict a so-called super coalition with her left-leaning opponents, the SPD. But could Frau Merkel surprise us all? Well, to discuss this further, we're joined on the line by Andreas Kluter, Berlin bureau chief for The Economist, and Werner Patzelt, Professor of Comparative Government at Dresden University of Technology. You're both very welcome to Midori House this morning. First of all, Andreas, just tell us about Merkel's victory last week and a little bit about that, an exploratory talk with the Social Democrats.
Well, her victory last week was a sort of paradoxical one in that she achieved a fantastic result for her party, about 42%. Which falls just short in terms of the seats in the Bundestag, the parliament, just short of an absolute majority by 5 seats. However, she lost her coalition partner, her current coalition partner, the Free Democratic Party, the Liberal Party, and that means she must, to get a majority in parliament, form a coalition with somebody, and that's the dilemma we're in that you just described. It's also interesting, I think, if you just step back and look at the victory again, since you wanted an overview, a slight majority of German voters voted for a right or center-right parties. However, some of those parties did not get into parliament, so a slight majority of parliament has gone to the left or center-left parties. So it's an interesting sort of, that also explains some of the cliffhanger in terms of the public mood. Should we go left or right?
Werner Patzelt, let's examine the first contender up in the possibility of the coalition. It's the most likely one that people are saying. It's a super coalition with the left-leaning opponents, the SPD. They came a distant second in these elections. Nonetheless, Frau Merkel will have to pay a price to stay in power. One of them was the loss of the finance ministry. How likely is that to happen?
Well, it's quite likely that we will have a coalition between the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, because this is exactly what the majority of Germans really want, as polls show. And of course, the CDU will have to pay a price, but the Social Democrats will have to pay a price as well, because they cannot deal with the Christian Democrats as if they were not second in rank, with a big distance to the Christian Democrats. And getting the Ministry of Finance might even be a mixed blessing, because they will have to sell all the payment obligations that Germany has accepted in the euro saving policies, and therefore it will be a give and take, and the Social Democrats will learn that all their hopes to bring a real change in German politics about will not come true.
Andreas, just to go back to the length of these talks, they're fairly crucial, aren't they? Do we need to get these talks over by the end of the year, if possible, because of the schedule for the euro area projects, such as the banking union, the bailout decisions regarding Greece and Portugal? That's all quite important in this, isn't it?
It's quite important, but nobody cares of the people who are involved in the coalition negotiations. That's one thing there, and some of this is posturing, some of this is tactics, we all understand that, but the SPD, certainly the Greens as well, the other option, they make clear in every statement they give that they have all the time in the world, and for instance, I think Andrea Nahles, the General Secretary of the Social Democrats, said this might take into January. So they have to say that, because otherwise they make themselves weaker in the coalition. But it is more complicated than it usually is in German politics. I recall the last time we had a grand coalition in 2005, it took 65 days to hammer the deal out. And this time it probably will take longer. So Yes, Europe and, in fact, the world, it's not just Europe, would like Germany to have a figure out its government situation as soon as possible. But the parties to the talks may want to take as long as possible.
Then, building on that, is Angela Merkel, in fact, in any rush to enter into a coalition with either the SPD or the Greens or even take a minority government? She got on very well with the Free Democratic Party, who were booted out. But if she keeps them for a little bit longer, she can exert her power for a little longer.
Well, Angela Merkel, after all, has a lot of time. Because if it's not possible to get to a stable coalition, say, until January, and if there is no chance to form a coalition with either the Social Democrats or the Greens, according to our constitution, Merkel can have elected her as a minority chancellor and then get from the federal president a decision to dissolve parliament. And in this case, the main issue, the main topic of the electoral campaign will be who is responsible for this unprecedented instability of the German political system. And of course, in such an electoral campaign, the Social Democrats and the Green will get the blame for the whole situation. And they are about to lose these elections even by a much greater margin than the last time. So if Merkel is acting in a rational way and in a patient way, the Social Democrats and the Greens won't be able to get as high a price for their participation in the coalition government as they might hope now. All depends on how patient Angela Merkel will be, and she is quite a patient person.
And Andreas, Angela Merkel is quite a force to be reckoned with, isn't she? Do the Green Party or the SPD have any chance in a coalition with her? There'll be difficulties, won't there?
Yes, she's a force to be reckoned with, and yes, they do have a chance because she needs them at the moment slightly more than either of them individually needs her. I mean, this is just a good old-fashioned deal-making now. She has to sacrifice some of her own darlings to get them to the table. That could be a minimum wage. That could even be, as we've been, there's been a talk inside the Christian Democratic Union all this week about whether they might even go back on their word and raise taxes here or there, maybe not call it that. And then the ministries and personnel staffing decisions. But an interesting possibility is that she might actually be watching with great interest what's happening in the Green Party right now, which is reinventing itself with essentially completely new leadership after the bad result 2 Sundays ago. And Angela Merkel may see greater potential for a really interesting collaboration with them. So it's good for her to have those waiting in the wings.
Andreas Klute, Berlin Bureau Chief for The Economist, and Werner Patzelt, who's from Dresden University of Technology. Thank you both, gentlemen, for your time discussing on how you attempt to govern in the shadow of Angela Merkel.
This week, Monocle 24 unpacks the world's most important and least understood industry, international shipping. It provides your shoes and phones, sunglasses and cars. But what happens between the factory floor and your front door? Tune in for gun-toting pirates and widening canals, modern clippers and eco-friendly designs. We'll also tour the biggest ship ever built. That's all this week on The Globalist at 6 a.m. London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Aperitivo is the latest addition to the Monocle 24 lineup. Airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time, Aperitivo is the perfect way to digest the day's biggest stories. From our studios at Midori House and over a flat white with special guests at the Monocle Cafe, we'll feature a relaxed blend of conversation and analysis that you simply won't hear anywhere else. That's Aperitivo, airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time. Brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
It's 8:24 in London and 14:24 in Jakarta, where we head now to get the latest news from our man there, Ben Bland. Welcome to the show, Ben. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott is in Indonesia of his first official visit. He said the two countries are united on the issue of asylum seekers. Can you tell us a bit more about it and whether it's true or not?
In recent years, with the acceleration of various conflicts in the Middle East and beyond, there's been a big uptick in the number of asylum seekers heading to Australia through a complex people smuggling network that goes via Indonesia, which is just 200 miles or so away from the Australian Christmas Island. This issue has become a really sore point in domestic Australian politics, and where although the number of boat-borne asylum seekers arriving there is rather small compared to countries like Italy and some of the Middle Eastern countries receive, it's been a big political issue in the elections. And Tony Abbott won last month, partly on his pledge to stop the boats. These are the sort of rickety fishing boats that bring asylum seekers from Indonesia to Australia's Christmas Island. Unfortunately, his plan to stop the boats was a bit of a sore point with Indonesia, because there are obviously sovereignty issues at play. But Mr. Abbott had just decided to focus on the business relationship with Indonesia on this trip, and try and put the asylum seeker issue to one side, really. So I think the two countries agreed not to agree for now and decided that they had a greater interest in trying to promote investments, cultural links, and trade between these two neighbours.
How much leverage does Indonesia have over Australia when it comes to the asylum seeker policy? I mean, obviously, the towback policy of Abbott backfired spectacularly last week with the death of I think it was up to 30 asylum seekers which sunk in Indonesian waters. Can Indonesia actually say, look, we're talking business, but you really do need to address this problem before we'll play any further?
Well, I think in a way it's the other way around. I mean, to be clear on the towbacks, it's not apparent if they've started yet. The boat that sank was just seems to have sunk because it wasn't in very good shape, but it does highlight the risks of that policy. And I think actually for Indonesia, it's a low order issue. It's a very important issue domestically in Australian politics, where, you know, like in the UK and many other countries, you know, asylum seekers have become a hot political issue. Indonesia is much more interested in trade and investment with Australia and making sure it has a relationship in which Australia treats Indonesia as at least an equal, if not more. So Indonesia is sort of happy to have the issue relegated. What tends to anger the Indonesian president and other politicians here is when Australia seems to put the blame for the asylum seeker issue at Indonesia, which after all is just a transit country. It's just not the source of these asylum seekers.
And Mr. Abbott did want to focus on trade on this trip, didn't he? And he said, forget Geneva, it's all about Jakarta and trading with them. And he's really pressed the point.
Well, I think that relates to some of the issues Australia faces going forward. It's had this long minerals boom, but there's a bit of nervousness now with China, which is one of the main buyers of Australia's minerals, saying it wants to grow at a slower and more sustainable path. There's nervousness in Australia about the future direction of their economy, which has been growing year on year for more than 20 years. And I think a key part of their future plan is deeper trade and investment ties with countries like Indonesia. I mean, I think at the moment, the trade relationship with tiny New Zealand is much bigger than it is with Indonesia, a country of 250 million people. And Mr. Abbott and Australian businesses see that potential and they want to advance those relationships. But I think it's going to be important for Australia not to upset Indonesia on issues like the asylum seekers or questions of Indonesia's sovereignty, which Indonesia is still very nervous about, if Australian companies and investors want to get better access to this market.
Let's move on to another subject, Ben. Anyone who's ever been to Jakarta knows it's a very busy place, traffic being a particular problem, and the Indonesian authorities are trying to address this, but it's not working quite as well as they'd liked, is it?
Well, they have a rather strange plan, and the government has just launched a new incentive scheme to promote what they're calling low-cost green cars. Now, there's no doubt that they're low-cost. The cheapest of these new cars are going to be around $7,000, as opposed to more than $10,000 US dollars, which is the cheapest entry-level car at the moment. They definitely use less fuel than the average car, but what looks likely to happen is these cheap cars are going to fuel even more rapid growth of the car market in Indonesia, which is already one of the fastest growing emerging markets for automobiles in the world. So some people think these new small cars could add another 40% to the market, which is already growing by about 1 million cars a year. And yet the road building, public transport, construction is not really progressing at any pace at all. So it looks like this is good news for the big auto manufacturers here, which are Toyota, Suzuki, and Nissan. Good news for poor people who want to trade up from a motorbike to their first car, but not really good news for people who have to face the Jakarta traffic.
And aren't there plans for people who are going to get hold of these cars to maybe put up parking tickets and road tax as well to combat this issue?
Well, there's a bit of a political spat going on. The central government has promoted these cars because they think it's a good way to appeal to the lower middle class ahead of elections next year. They also think it's a good way to promote jobs in Indonesia's automobile manufacturing industry. But the governor of Jakarta, Joko Widodo, who many people would like to run for the presidency next year, has opposed the plan, saying, as you said, that Jakarta doesn't have the capacity for these extra cars, and he is working on plans to bring in road charging, perhaps like London's congestion charging or Singapore's electric road pricing, or alternatively whacking up parking charges to make it much harder for car users. So it seems there's going to be a battle between these various interest groups, the car makers, the central government, the governor of Jakarta, and other mayors of Jakarta, of Indonesia's other traffic-clogged cities. We'll have to see who wins, but certainly the car lobby here has a lot of power because they employ a lot of people. And, you know, as in many countries, it's many people's dream here to own their own new car. It's seen as the status symbol and the sign that you've made it and you're moving ahead in life.
Ben Bland in Jakarta, thank you very much as ever for joining us on the programme.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be in Dublin for the city's annual theatre festival. We'll review the Brazilian newspapers and we'll find out whether there is still space for the unloved and underused brand HTC with the company's senior vice president, Scott Croyle.
If a photo captures 1,000 words, what does a video capture? You know, it captures kind of an infinite amount, even just in a little 3-second clip.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Victoria. The US federal government will start partially shutting down today after lawmakers failed to compromise on an emergency spending bill before a midnight deadline. It's not known how long the shutdown will last. Up to 1 million federal workers face being placed on unpaid leave. Venezuela has expelled 3 US diplomats who it says were trying to sabotage the economy. President Nicolas Maduro says he has evidence they were involved in sabotaging the power grid last month and that they'd bribed Venezuelan companies to cut production. Syria's foreign minister has claimed terrorists from more than 83 countries are killing soldiers and civilians. In a speech to the UN General Assembly, Walid Mualem compared this so-called invasion to the 9/11 attacks on New York. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has announced major political reforms which include new Kurdish rights. He's proposed lowering the 10% electoral threshold, which currently prevents Kurdish and other smaller parties from entering parliament. The US Senate Foreign Relations Committee has unanimously backed Caroline Kennedy, daughter of the late President John F. Kennedy, as the next US ambassador to Japan. This paves the way for what should be an easy vote in the full Senate. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Victoria Graham and Emma Nelson. In this week's edition of Section D, the team will be speaking to a couple of people who know just a thing or two about combining design and technology. First up, they meet Yves Bihar, founder of San Francisco-based design agency Fuse Project. His company has worked on projects that range from providing the first $100 laptop for the one laptop per child scheme to designing a beverage carbonator for SodaStream.
All that's come. But however, in this preview, we talk phone design. The likes of Apple and Samsung have dominated the market. So is there still space for the likes of the unloved and underused brand HTC? Well, one man who certainly thinks so is Scott Croyle. He's senior vice president of HTC, and he talked to Monocle's Alad John a little earlier.
Design is obviously a very important thing for HTC. Your company has some big traits and big features. Which ones stand out for you as the kind of symbols of HTC's emblem of good design?
Sure. So I think if we go back to the HTC One and the One Mini, which have both launched this year, kind of part of our flagship line. The HTC One, I think let's start off with the industrial design. I think the first thing to note about it is that it's got an all-metal construction, which was a big breakthrough in the industry. You know, if you look at most phones, even if there's metal, they'll either have glass or plastic over where the antennas typically are. So the HTC One really kind of takes that to the next level. And on top of that, we also developed this zero-gap construction, which means that the fit and finish is really perfect. And we really feel like, in terms of industrial design, it's really executed at kind of a very superior level. I think one of the other features on the HTC One is boom sound, which is the dual front-facing speakers. I think there were a lot of questions of whether we could make it fit in, but you know, I think we'd all been in those moments where you're at a bar or you're at a party with a friend, you're actually trying to show them some video on YouTube or Vimeo, and no, you know, everybody's trying to gather around, trying to hear it. Yeah. And it just kind of made sense when the idea came up, like, oh, yeah, of course, that would be great if we could put that in. So I think it's emblematic of kind of the way we think and kind of where these kind of little kernels come from. I think in terms of the user experience, I think there's a couple of key features. Number one is Blink, which I already talked about a little bit, but I think also there's been a lot of investment in the camera and those experiences. I think in particular, one of the features that I really love is the highlight movies. What it does is it takes your photos and your videos, and it basically automatically puts together a 30-second clip. And then you can go back and remix it, and it does it all on the fly. So you can remix it, you can add a music track to it, and actually have this, not just a photo that you're sharing with people that maybe you've run through some effect, but a whole movie that really captures a lot more than just a photo. In fact, you know, if a photo captures 1,000 words, what is a video capture? You know, it captures kind of an infinite amount, even just in a little 3-second clip.
I wonder, it's a Taiwanese company, but where's the spiritual home for HTC? Is it in America? Where do you see the most rapturous reception to the design or the new designs that come out? Is your target market Asia or is it the West?
I think that HTC is a global company, and I think without a doubt it does well in Taiwan. And I think just because of, if you talk to the Taiwanese, this is their crown jewel. It really is a great success story out of Taiwan. Having said that, I think the markets really to be relevant that we have to be relevant in are Europe. UK is very strong for us. Germany is also very strong for us. So I think in terms of the top two markets in Europe, we're actually doing very well. And then the United States is another key market. A lot of the innovation, if it's not successful in the United States, it's really not going to make traction just culturally in the rest of the world. And so that's key. And I think as you look over the next 3 or 4 years, obviously China is a big growing market. So there's a lot of opportunity there. We're just kind of dipping our toe in and kind of getting started there. But we think there's a lot of opportunity for us.
What does the short-term future hold for HTC? Which challenges lie ahead for you? What are you really looking forward to as VP of design? Are you given kind of a blank canvas, say, here's your budget, go off, create kind of thing?
In the short term for the company, I think the first thing to do is figure out what's wrong with the company and then start working on an execution strategy and actually develop and articulate a clear strategy to both the market and our employees. And that's already in process. And so I'm actually pretty excited about moving forward over the next, 3 to 6 months, because I think you'll see some traction and some good news kind of coming within a 6-month period around that. In terms of design, there's a couple of things that we're working on that I'm super, super excited about. Things that could actually move beyond just the phone and create a real opportunity for HTC. And so I'm really excited about kind of what that could mean for HTC and you know, how we as a company kind of can learn and grow from that exercise.
Scott Coyle there, Senior Vice President of Design for HTC, talking to Monocle's Alid John. To hear the full chat, tune into the brand new episode tomorrow night or tonight, depending on where you are in the world, of Section D at 1900 hours London time. You're listening to Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:38 a.m. It has been a rough week for Minneapolis since Kenyan authorities claimed that some of the Nairobi mall terrorists were teenagers from the Twin Cities. The Somali immigrant population in the city has suffered from the Al-Shabaab association, even though there's no real proof that any of the attackers were from the U.S.
Minneapolis's mayor, R.T. Ryback, has made a point of turning his city into a prejudice-free area. In the decade and change he has held office, he has welcomed immigration from Somalia and Liberia, and more recently he's been touring those US states which remain convinced that gay marriage is any threat to anything to encourage gay couples to wed in Minnesota. A little earlier, Ryback visited Midori House and spoke to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Minneapolis is a place that has always welcomed people. We don't have time to hate. We get to work. So that means that immigrants have been very welcome for many, many years. But I was literally elected on 9/11. I won the primary that day. And while so much of America turned its back on the values of the Statue of Liberty, we really said, welcome, come on in. And so now, over these past years, since 2001, we started a summer job training program, and we've taken 18,000 young people, half of them from immigrant families. So 9,000 young people from immigrant families, got them into quality summer jobs, got them into college. They're getting out of college. They're in the workforce. So think about this for a minute. If we have 9,000 kids from immigrant families, we have an enormous population from Somalia, Liberia, Ethiopia. We now are, I believe, Minneapolis is positioned to be the single best asset the United States has, and one of the best assets all of the West has in competing with China and Africa. That's the way of looking at diversity and inclusion as an asset.
Now, it's been a very difficult week for the Somali community in Minneapolis because the events in Nairobi with the attack on the Westgate Mall and the suggestions, as yet entirely unproven, from the Kenyan foreign minister that some of the attackers were from Minnesota. Before we get on to the broader issue, how have things been this week in terms of how that community has felt and the reactions towards them?
Well, I have to say it's a deeply troubling issue. And having been gone for a few days, I'm very, very in touch with our staff and others. But I couldn't represent exactly how everyone in the community is feeling. But I know from what's happened over the last few years how it feels when there's an allegation, and sadly sometimes true, that a young person has been recruited to work with you know, folks who are doing some not so great things in Somalia. I think we have to appreciate, first off, that that needs to be taken very seriously, and second, that it's, you have to put in the same package as, say, a young person from of Irish descent living in, say, Boston, recruited to be part of, say, the IRA. Mm. Being, you know, whether someone is pulled into something that is potentially, you know, violent. You also have to recognize that, you know, Americans certainly, who are all from somewhere else, except for our native people, identify with other countries. It's natural to want to, quote unquote, help the homeland. What we feel we need to do is to, frankly, out-recruit the people, recruiting people moving into the wrong direction. So we've been very engaged in saying to the Somali population in Minnesota, you are here in large part because of the humanitarian relief efforts. Now be part of going back to helping the homeland and not getting involved in these other areas. So we've done very exciting relief efforts in Puntland, for instance, which is a part of Somalia that is probably the most stable. And so we have many, many, many young people in Minneapolis helping the young people of Puntland. And that needs to be put up against two young people who may have been involved in a heinous act with a very, very large population. And so I think we have to understand the nuance of it. We have to be tough about enforcement, but we also have to realize that there's a population to be inspired and engaged in rebuilding what hopefully someday will be a more stable country.
Do you often feel you're a bit of a lonely voice in America? When we look at the general political voices in the US, you know, the people that we hear in Europe here being described as liberal, often we think, really? That's your left wing?
Yeah.
It can be difficult to find voices like your own, which are, you know, truly liberal from a European perspective.
Well, I felt very, very alone in the early years as mayor in 2002 and 2003. And mercifully, I had a great senator, Paul Wellstone, who was a real mentor of mine. And I was talking to him a lot about the very negative messages about immigration we were getting from the Bush administration. He was helping me about that and then very tragically died in a plane crash. So, yeah, I did, frankly, feel very isolated at that time. I was one of the very few American elected officials very well in advance of Iraq to talk about what a mistake that was. I feel very differently now. I was the first mayor in the country to support President Obama and was very engaged with him from the beginning. And I think people around the world need to recognize what this president has done to dramatically turn around what has happened. And I feel now, especially, and as I was talking about how our population's diversity is an asset, I spend a lot of time trying to carry that message because so many Americans often forget the value of why America is, the United States is a great country. I am engaged in a world economy as a mayor of an American city of Minneapolis, and that I am also a global citizen on the streets of London. And that doesn't have to do with all these constrictions that somehow there's a massive one think in America or one think in England or Europe.
RT Ryback there, Mayor of Minneapolis, talking to Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Monocle 24. We head to Brazil next.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it.
Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
From Mali to Martinique, every 4 years, the best athletes from the French-speaking world gather for the Francophone Games. Monocle's Steve Blomfield reports from Nice on the event, which, for the French, is about more than simply sport.
The Gabonese table tennis team is filming every second, ready to send all the footage home. The Armenians cheer on their wrestlers as if they were competing at the Olympics. Chad versus Côte d'Ivoire in the wrestling, Haiti versus Lebanon in the football. None of these are a clash of the titans, but watching a Chadian wrestler thump his chest in celebration as the buzzer goes, hearing the cry of anguish from a Djiboutian table tennis player as he loses a tight set, this means something.
You can watch Steve Blomfield's sporting report and over 350 more films on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time here in London is just nudging 8:47. In a moment, Fernando Augusto Pacheco is standing by to bring us today's very Brazilian-themed newspaper review. Taking us there, apparently we have to brace our ears for this. This is Anita Show das Poderosas. Anita there with Show das Poderosas. The choice of Fernando Augusto Pacheco, today's paper reviewer, who will be casting a Brazilian sheen over the newspaper. But before that, just tell us about your musical choice there, because that first of all, my ears hurt at the beginning.
I was thinking of you too when I chose this song.
What, you're taking us to some dodgy club?
No, it's literally the translation is the show of powerful women.
Oh,
exactly. Right. So,
last week, apparently, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, you did something about people who had big bottoms. What are you trying to say about your presenters?
Yeah, big bottoms and powerful women. Is that something to do with me?
Welcome to Monocle 24.
You're two beautiful women.
Where the ladies look like wrestlers.
I can guarantee you, listeners, that they definitely don't look like wrestlers. Or just two very pretty wrestlers, I have to say.
That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. Faye, what is in the papers today?
Well, first I'd like to talk about a story that's been everywhere in the Brazilian press, in Folha de São Paulo, Globo, the fact that Dilma is back to social media. And that's quite surprising because her last posts were when she won the election in 2010. And it was a very kind of serious message, like, thank you very much for voting for me. But suddenly she's everywhere, you know, and out of nowhere, basically. In Brazil, we have a website called Dilma Bolada, which translates into English is called Furious Dilma. He's like a comedian that makes like kind of lighthearted fun of Dilma, you know, talking about, oh, she's a powerful woman, she's quite severe in the way she looks and kind of the way she acts as well. But actually, she invited him to come to her office and they, you know, they posted things on Facebook, on Twitter together. And the first message actually is she said to everyone, good morning, beautiful, wonderful. Like I'm translating literally. So she's been so relaxed.
Now, forgive me for being cynical about this, but why would she possibly want to enter this when her election is when?
Next year.
Right.
Well, she's doing a lot of things to convince the Brazilian voters to vote for her. You know, she stand up to the US in this spying scandal as well, which was great. And now she's doing well in the polls at the moment, because after the protest that we had in June, she was quite low on the polls as well. She used to have like 60% before. After the protest, 30%. At the moment, she's currently like 40, around 40%. So yeah, of course, you know, we have to be cynical about that. You know, she wants to kind of warm up to Brazilians and kind of saying that she's, yeah, she's not as stern. And maybe she's behaving a little bit like Lula, our previous president, who was very an emotional guy. He used to cry in public. He used to be very warm. And she's more like a kind of technocratic, you know, she's very kind of serious. I never seen her crying or something like that.
Do you think this charm offensive will work?
I think it will, actually, you know. I think Brazilians love that, you know. And you know, and it's funny, for example, she criticized as well the latest issue of The Economist. And because, you know, they criticized, they did a special on Brazil, criticizing our lack of infrastructure, saying that we need to do a lot of reforms. And she basically said they don't know anything about Brazil.
I mean, social media, I mean, it does appeal to a lot of people. So maybe that is the point of it. She also mentions the rumor that she escaped from her office without telling anyone to ride a motorcycle.
Exactly. There was only a rumor. But then she posted saying, yes, she really did it. And she even made again, she's joking all the time now. Oh, my God, it's such a big change. You know, the film Fast and Furious. She's like, she's saying, I'm fast and furious. So yeah, big change yeah. There.
She has, I mean, is she doing anything to address this thing? Because the article in The Economist was fairly brutal.
Very brutal.
Yeah, it's absolutely saying that, you know, I'm just looking at it now, rotten infrastructure, loads of unnecessary costs on businesses. And that's just the start of it. It goes and basically unpicks Brazil. What is Dilma doing actually now to try to counteract those problems? Because Brazil has been under huge criticism for a long time, not least because of its preparations for the Olympics and the World Cup.
And there is a lack of investment. And I think all Brazilians know about that, you know. But, well, she did say that she has a new program called PAC, which is programs for this kind of big construction, you know, especially for the World Cup, because, you know, it's true, Brazil doesn't have the transport infrastructure we need. So, well, I'm sure she's trying, but I don't think she's realizing that actually, you know, in terms of infrastructure, Brazil is one of the worst countries in the planet, I have to say. You know, that's a shame, because at the same time, we have good things as well. People are earning more, you know, salaries are rising all the time, you know, people are getting less poor, you know, so there are a lot of good things about Brazil, but we have to watch out for those bad things as well.
And she likes football, I see, as well.
She likes football. You know, one of our main players, Ronaldinho, he had to do surgery, to be honest. I don't know what is happening, but she said, good luck, Ronaldinho, you know, and I'll be praying for you or something like that.
A softer side.
Yeah, softer side. I kind of like her new side, you know, because, yeah, maybe because I'm Brazilian.
Let's have a look at this Folha de São Paulo, which is has an amazing picture.
Talking about infrastructure here.
Yeah. Mm.
So there's an interesting picture. I mean, there's like a concrete in the city that there'll be a train suspended in the air. It's called Monotrilho. And but a lot of paulistanos, the residents of São Paulo, are not, they don't like that because it looks a bit... Can you see the picture? What do you think about it? It's too much concrete, I have to say.
Well, it's going straight in front of people's houses as well and people's residences.
Exactly.
So.
And it's interesting. I think it's a change of mind in the residents of São Paulo because I think people are becoming more and more worried about the visual impact of this kind of constructions in their city, you know. And São Paulo was notoriously famous for the Cidade Limpa project, which basically banned outdoor advertisement in the city. So... to be honest, now the law was kind of relaxed a little bit.
It astonishes me slightly because if you think, well, I think about Brazil and architecture, I think of Niemeyer and Brasilia. And so you have this wonderful image of progressive, beautiful buildings. Why do you think they've gone for ugly?
Well,
or is it cheap?
To be honest, I mean, we do, well, thankfully we have this beautiful image of Niemeyer, but actually if you walk to São Paulo, sometimes you have this awful neoclassic buildings as well. So we do have the bad side. We just don't like to show it to the world.
Mm-hmm.
We keep it quiet about it.
This is the week you can create a new political party before the 2014 presidential elections. If you're thinking about it, get it done now.
Exactly. Wow. And in Brazil, every year, new political parties are created. Actually, we have 32 political parties at the moment, which is quite a lot. I was doing, in terms of comparison, I believe Germany and France, which are well known for having a lot of political parties, but they have like around 16 or 18. We have 32. And actually, there are two new political parties were created last week, PROS and Solidariedade. But the main story on that is that Marina Silva, she used to be our former Green Party leader, and she's actually the second place on the presidential polls for next year. She has like around 22% of the intention of vote, and she wants to create a new party called Rede, but she didn't manage to get the 500,000 signatures needed. So today she's going to talk to the president of the electoral court to see if she can, if there's another way of creating a party. I'll be quite surprised if she didn't manage, because she's doing so well in the polls, you know. And to be honest, I think Dilma would be somehow happy if she didn't manage, because she will be kind of her main disputing.
She needs to start tweeting, doesn't she?
Well, absolutely.
Or going on a mic bike, more likely.
Absolutely.
The fact that you have 32 parties in the country, I mean, that must be brilliant for democracy, but very bad for steering a country.
Absolutely. And those parties that we have, they lack ideology, you know. In Brazil, it's very difficult to define if a party is centre-left or centre-right. Sometimes they're just there to be part of the government base. And you know, so that's why in Brazil we have a lot of corruption, a lot of scandals. Of course, you have some exceptions. And I would even say that this new party that Marina Silva wants to create would be an exception for that, but she might not even get it.
The president of the Supreme Court is not happy about it, is he at all?
He's definitely not happy about it. Joaquim Barbosa, which many Brazilians like it because he commanded the Mensalão case, which was our biggest corruption scandal, and he's well known. Brazilians love him, and actually a lot of people would like to see him as a presidential candidate next year, but he already said that he doesn't want it. So even in Carnival, a lot of people were wearing Joaquim Barbosa's masks because they liked him so much. Mm. So you can party like dressed as Joaquim Barbosa.
Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, as ever, thank you very much indeed. And thank you for calling us pretty wrestlers. We won't forget that. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Barbara Feeney, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, he of the pretty wrestler reputation. You are in such trouble, Faye. And Harry Upthought too, and to our studio manager, Bill Lutie.
Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. I'll be back with Marcus Hippie for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.